With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Dairies struggle as milk prices plummet and production costs surge. After earning record high milk prices in 2022, dairy farmers have seen their earnings plummet in recent months. With more operations struggling to stay in business and some closing their doors for good. Their plight has promoted comparison to the 2009 economic crisis that forced droves of dairies into bankruptcy. Some say it may be worse this time around due to additional inflationary pressures and higher interest rates that make it more costly for businesses to borrow money. Dairy farmers' costs for feed, labor, fuel, and fertilizers have all skyrocketed. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and we'll hear more on this topic later in today's show. But right now, we've also got another report on the dairy industry and how lawmakers are moving forward with some sustainability efforts. Let's take a listen to today's headline reports. In today's Ag News from AgNet West, the introduction of the Cows Act. More after the break. A new manure management conservation program was recently introduced by five representatives from California, Ohio, and Maine. The COWS Act is a bipartisan, bicameral legislation, and it would establish a new manure management conservation program to improve air quality and implement sustainable farming practices. California leads the nation in dairy production. Bill co-author Congressman Jim Costa says it also leads the nation in, quote, the implementation of alternative manure management systems, helping provide a significant reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. This bill would allow other major producing states to follow in California's steps. Co-author Congressman Shelley Pingree of Maine says, quote, with agriculture accounting for approximately 11% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, it's crucial we empower farmers to be a part of a climate solution, and the upcoming Farm Bill gives us a once-in-a-five-year opportunity to ensure they have the resources so they can be. She adds, quote, the COWS Act will help our dairy and livestock farmers transition to sustainable practices to reduce methane gas emissions on their farms. This bipartisan legislation is a win-win for the agriculture industry and for the environment. This bill is endorsed by California Dairies, the Environmental Working Group, the National Sustainable Agricultural Coalition, and the National Milk Producers Federation. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Demographic changes in Mexico are putting more pressure on labor availability. Senior analyst covering fruits and tree nuts for Rabo Agri Finance, David Magana, described the outlook and impact of labor challenges in Mexico.
California ag has relied on migrant labor for decades. And now when I visit our clients in Mexico, many of them mention that one of the biggest challenges is finding enough workers. So, you know, like there are some underlying demographic changes, particularly natality rates, that have impacted the availability of workers. So, that's going to create a permanent change in the number of workers that are going to be available for California agriculture. So that's why we need to increasingly rely on innovations to make the available labor force more efficient to remain competitive.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture's Bureau of Livestock Identification has announced vacancies on the Livestock Identification Advisory Board. The board's purpose is to make recommendations to the Secretary of Agriculture on hide and brand laws, the curbing of livestock theft, procedures followed by the Bureau, and the program's annual budget. The term of office for members of the Livestock Advisory Board is 4 years, and members receive no compensation but are entitled to mileage reimbursement. The present board membership consists of 2 beef cattle producers, 2 dairy producers, 2 registered feedlot operators, and 1 livestock marketing business. As of June, 1 beef cattle producer position has become vacant. Anyone interested in representing beef cattle producers is asked to send a brief resume by August 31st. More information is available on the Bureau of Livestock Identification page at cdfa.ca.gov. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do you listen? I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
News on the radio, it's nice because it's just a quick snippet and I don't have to go searching for it or grab a paper.
I listen to radio because anywhere that I'm going, I'm listening to music or I'm listening to a talk show or I'm just trying to stay up on current events.
I always turn into the radio to see if I need to take shelter, where it's hitting, to see what I need to be preparing for.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, we continue our coverage of the proposed Ag Appropriations Amendment that is under fire from checkoff organizations. Earlier this week, we heard from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, and today we hear from the embattled Indiana Congresswoman who proposed the amendment. Congresswoman Victoria Spartz says she's striving for transparency in checkoff programs with her amendment to the Ag Appropriations Bill. The amendment states that no federal money will go to the programs. National Cattlemen's Beef Association Vice President of Government Affairs Ethan Lane says it's unnecessary because no federal money actually goes to the programs. However, Spartz says it's a move toward giving Congress the ability to regulate the programs.
There is a problem with checkoff. They're not transparent. They are not telling what's happening with these boards, who's serving on these boards, what they're doing, how they spend money. This is a fee that farmers are forced to pay. It's not a voluntary fee. Congress forces every farmer to pay this tax. So Congress needs to know what they're doing, and farmers need to know what they're doing. And it is, there is no transparency. I haven't seen what they're doing on the ground. But I'll tell you, we have a huge now monopoly issues in farming like any other industry. And larger farmers and few getting bigger and bigger. We have oligopolies controlling our meat processing. We have a more and more, you know, bigger entities, you know, centralizing more power. And as a little guy, it's very hard to enter the market and compete and have more value. I think it's important to us to bring more competition in this farm bill and more transparency to see. So this group shouldn't be upset. If you do something so good for farmers and consumers, why are you so upset to have transparency? If you are not willing to have it, then it seems strange to me. You know, because if you're doing some of the good causes, if you really have, very good intent, you would not worry to bring transparency.
Spartz says she has personal experience with checkoff programs, but still doesn't see where her money is going.
As you know, I'm a farmer myself. I actually pay this fee. It's very interesting that Cattle Association actually wrote that I don't know what I'm talking about. No, I just sold over 50,000 bushels of wheat and paid the fees. So I understand what it is about, but I haven't seen what these organizations are doing. I know that they're paying big salaries to their boards. So I think we need to look, make sure, you know, that this organization is really serving the purpose to promote agriculture, not to promote few oligarchs and large monopolies or their interests and for people sitting on the board. So I think we need to have transparency on the farm bill. And it's very interesting for me, if they believe there is no federal money is going to that, why they're so upset. You know, I don't understand why they're so upset. That makes me wonder. So I think it's interesting. The process is very strange because we should have farm authorization before appropriations. And I'm going to have amendment in the farm bill to bring more transparency to this program. Actually, government accountability office raised these questions for a while now. And I think farmer needs to know and consumer what these organizations are doing. Because it's, I mean, it's roughly $1 billion get paid and government require farmers to pay these fees. I don't think it's unreasonable.
The amendment was met with opposition from industry groups, including the American Soybean Association, National Pork Producers Council, National Milk Producers Federation, NCBA, and the Indiana Beef Cattle Association, which together issued a news statement calling the amendment legally frivolous, since federal money is not used for checkoff groups. Spartz counters that it is a first step in creating congressional oversight of the organizations. You can read the full story and hear the full interviews with both Spartz and Lane on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the dairy industry has a few of its own laws of supply and demand, one of which will likely be operating next year. With more details, here's Gary Crawford.
In the world of ag economics, there are a few unwritten rules that are almost always proven to be true, right?
Exactly.
USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Tekanowski, in this case, we're talking about a rule that seems to apply year after year in the dairy industry, and that rule
milk production tends to always trends higher with population growth and with dairy demand growth generally.
Case in point, USDA's projection for milk production in 2024.
Milk production is expected to be up 2.2 billion pounds.
Up about 1% from this year at 230.6 billion pounds. Another economics rule, more output brings lower producer prices. And indeed, look at Mark's all milk average price outlook for next year.
Currently forecast at $19.10 per hundredweight, and that would be down 45 cents year over year.
Or about a 2% drop. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. Last week, a group of lawmakers introduced legislation to exclude reporting of routine emissions from livestock farms to state and local emergency response authorities. And the National Pork Producers Council supports the legislation. Pork producers and, of course, other livestock industries have engaged with federal and state regulators for decades over permitting and reporting of air emissions. The engagement has included both the air consent agreements that many producers signed, exempting them from having to file emergency reports to first responders. Back in 2018, Congress permanently exempted livestock farmers from having to report emissions under the Superfund law to the U.S. Coast Guard's National Response Center. At the same time, EPA exempted those same farms from making similar reports to state and local first responders. Following litigation, the Biden administration agreed to reopen that rulemaking to reconsider the exemption from the emergency release reporting rule. Now, the new legislation would clarify that the 2018 Farms Act and EPA's prior regulations were correct, and the livestock farms should not be required to inundate local fire departments with emission reports. And farmers who utilize manure as a fertilizer mostly get the livestock byproduct from their own operations. New data from USDA's Economic Research Service shows most manure applied to U.S. cropland, 78% comes from animals raised on the same operation. 14% is purchased, 8% is obtained at no cost from other animal operations. In 2020, manure was applied to about 8% of the 241 million acres planted to seven major U.S. field crops. Most crops, farmers use manure that either comes from their own farm or at no cost from other farms, but cotton and peanut producers are the most likely to purchase manure, typically from poultry growers, as poultry litter has the highest nutrient content, thus making it less costly to transport. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
There's a request for information from cotton growers around the U.S. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Cotton Incorporated is asking all U.S. cotton producers to take the 2023 Natural Resource Survey. The survey will guide Cotton Incorporated's future research priorities and help document U.S. cotton production improvements. The online survey should only take 25 to 30 minutes to complete, and participants who complete the survey before July 31st will be mailed a free 30-ounce Yeti Rambler Cup featuring the Seal of Cotton trademark. Only aggregated data from the survey will be used. No individual grower data will be shared. Cotton Incorporated says having a representative data set of U.S. cotton production is critical to help tell U.S. cotton sustainability story and document continuous improvement in the industry. To take the survey, cotton producers should visit www.cottoninc.com/agsurvey. We've put a link on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen. For 2023, you can make gifts of up to $17,000 of cash or property value per donee, and it's not a taxable gift. These annual exclusion gifts are a good way to get value out of your estate tax-free and avoid estate tax on them if you have an estate that would be subject to federal estate tax. But what about checks written before death that aren't cashed until after death? Is the value of those checks out of your estate? Is the value of checks written before death but cashed after death out of your estate? In a recent case, a son with a power of attorney over a parent's investment account wrote 11 checks totaling $464,000 to family members. 10 of the checks weren't cashed until after the parent died. The parent's estate did not include the value of the checks, but the IRS did and said the estate owed $132,000 in federal estate tax. The tax court agreed with the IRS, and so did the appellate court. Many farmers write checks to children at year-end for the annual exclusion gift amount of $17,000. If any check isn't cashed before year-end, the gift is not complete until the next year. That could result in a doubling up of the gifts, the filing of a gift tax return, and the use of some of the unified credit for estate and gift tax purposes. Be careful with year-end gifts and get them cashed before the new year. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
The group is led by CEO and Executive Chairman Tom Bias, former CEO of Growth Energy and President of the National Farmers Union. He says the alliance was formed to talk about the benefits of the technology to everyone in rural America.
Everyone from the farmers that grow the corn to the ethanol producers and the communities that these plants reside in. Oftentimes the debate has been about a lot of emotional issues and not necessarily about the benefits. So we created an alliance, and this alliance is to bring in everybody and anyone who's involved in the carbon capture industry in rural America to talk about these benefits. We just want them to be part of the debate, not exclusively based on emotional issues.
He talks about some of the specific benefits that carbon capture offers to rural America.
It lowers the carbon index for the production of ethanol, and the production of ethanol then qualifies for any future fuels. Sustainable aviation fuel, for example, is a potential 100 billion gallon market worldwide, and the airline companies are all under the gun to reduce their carbon score, and ethanol won't qualify as a feedstock to produce sustainable aviation fuel unless we get our carbon index down. So the ripple effect backs it up, where you have less demand for corn, and less demand for corn usually leads to oversupply. Oversupply leads to lower prices to the farmer. That's what we're seeking to avoid.
Bias says a lot of carbon exits an ethanol plant through its smokestack.
So they capture that carbon going up the smokestack. They process it and compress it, and it's shipped through pipelines to areas of the country where you can safely store it, where it has some structure to be able to put it into the ground and cap it and keep it forever. In the Midwest, those two locations right now are North Dakota and Illinois. And so you have a wide swath of the ethanol industry that's located in between those two locations. And so you have to get it to the areas that the rock formation will allow to be kept.
Pipeline placement and construction has been a hot button issue recently. Bias says many people may not realize that there are millions of miles of pipelines around the country.
Shipping carbon by pipeline is the most efficient manner. It's the safest manner. If you had to rail or truck carbon, it's a lot more dangerous transportation mode than pipelines. And pipelines can be safely put into the ground. And I think all the companies involved, and there's several companies that are building pipelines, have all said that they were going to ensure that the yield capability of the land where the pipelines go. They're offering huge lease payments to farmers. And I think what you ultimately will see is the pipelines approved and moving forward to the areas of the country that can store it.
For more information, go to AmericanCarbonAlliance.org. Chad Smith reporting.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food, And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
We focus on the wheat trade today, and more specifically, spring wheat. I'm Mark Oppel with today's bottom line report brought to you by Helena Agri. 55 participants in a 17-car cavalcade have been going through the spring wheat and durum wheat belt this week, but meeting in Fargo today to end the tour, compare notes, and release final estimates. Minneapolis futures have followed a similar path, that of Kansas City and Chicago wheat futures this second half of July, but look a little toppy here now as we move toward the end of the week and the end of the month. 950 basis September futures looks like a solid resistance level in our view, but $9.895 looks to be good support. Corn and soybeans look to have a volatile end of the week. We are in Baltic, South Dakota today. This is the Ag PhD Field Day. 98, 99 degrees expected high and more the same through the weekend. This is the bottom line report. Look for live cattle, feeder cattle to finish the week strong. Heat will affect daily movement, cattle and hogs. That's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Taking a look at some crop conditions from around the nation. It's that time of year when experts scout fields for crop conditions. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says corn is having a rough season in several states.
Our troubled states are mostly in the middle to western part of the Corn Belt, and we have Missouri leading again this week. 39% of the corn crop rated very poor to poor, followed by Illinois at 22%. And then we have a pair of states, Wisconsin and Nebraska, coming in this week, 15% very poor to poor.
And he has a look at the overall corn condition.
Now, in terms of the stage of development for the corn crop, more than two-thirds of the crop silking by July 23rd. The national number is 68%. That is ahead of the five-year average of 65%, also ahead of last year's 58%.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
How to increase competition in the U.S. economy, particularly in the food and farm sectors? That has been a subject of study and focus in recent years.
That's why 2 years ago I signed an executive order to create this council, increase competition, and lower costs for American households.
Efforts of President Joe Biden's White House Competition Council include a newly announced partnership between the Agriculture Department and attorneys general across the country
to leverage both federal and state resources to combat anti-competitive and anti-consumer behavior.
And while Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced the new partnership, USDA economic researcher James McDonald and others were involved in a recent study into consolidation of various food and farm industries and their impacts on competition. They all joined me, Rod Bain, for a look at improving competition within our nation's ag economy in this edition of Agriculture USA. A recent meeting of the White House Competition Council featured announcements of the latest in efforts to enhance competition and protect consumers in food and agricultural markets.
The Department of Agriculture, together with bipartisan attorneys general in 31 states and the District of Columbia, are ramping up enforcement of antitrust and consumer protection laws in food and in agriculture.
President Joe Biden says the formation of the Agricultural Competition Partnership is part of a recently signed executive order on promoting competition in the American economy. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack explains the framework of this newly established partnership.
We're pooling both our investigative resources and our legal authorities. That's going to enable us to better crack down on anti-competitive and anti-consumer practices that raise prices at the grocery store and deprive farmers of a fair return. This enforcement partnership will address the lack of competition in a range of markets, including consolidation of grocery markets that are now dominated by large chains, consolidation in the meat and poultry processing, among others. farmers.
Secretary Vilsack adds the Agricultural Competition Partnership builds upon USDA examples of fostering increased competition in the farm and food sectors. Examples such as...
I met with business owners in Iowa to announce USDA's investments in 15 additional nationwide projects that will expand independent meat and poultry processing capacity. We're also working swiftly to finish a suite of robust new rules under the Packers and Stockyards Act that will protect independent farmers and ranchers from abuse by the dominant meat and poultry processors. And we're also committed to finishing our work ensuring that when you see product of the USA on a food product, consumers will know that everything done to raise and process that product was done here at home. We've established a Farmer Seed Liaison Initiative, which will provide farmers a voice and greater transparency in seed patents to help provide choice and lower costs for producers.
USDA's Economic Research Service recently published findings of a long-term study on competition and how the concentration of various ag and food sectors created impacts. Economic researcher James McDonald says three agribusiness sectors specifically were highlighted in this report: meat packing, seeds, and food retail.
We chose these sectors because they've had really striking transformations in how business is organized within each sector over the last 20 or 30 years. And as part of that, many specific markets within each sector have become highly concentrated with just a few producers.
Among the research findings in the report for the meat packing industry,
it appears that packers have been able to exercise more market power since around 2016. At the same time, we've started to see entry by new packing plants and new firms into the business just in recent years, which is both an indication of market power and a potential solution to it by expanding capacity and offering more competition for current packers.
While in the seed industry, two seed companies accounted for 72% of planted corn acres and 66% of planted soybean acres in the U.S. in 2018. In food retail, local and regional markets is where competition is most likely to occur. McDonald says all these findings illustrate,
although concentration has increased, that is, we've gone to fewer but larger producers in many sectors, the complexity here is that that doesn't always represent a reduction of competition. It does in many cases, but not always. And as a result, we need to be careful in evaluating what a change in concentration might mean for the nature of competition in an industry.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. Today, we're joined by Senior Specialist of Industry Relations for the Almond Board, Rebecca Bailey, to talk a little bit about this year's Almond Conference happening in December. And now, Rebecca, I know you get a lot of feedback and do a lot of contemplation about how the event's going to take place, how it's going to unfold. But just kind of to be clear here up front, we are going to be back in Sacramento again this year, correct?
Yes, that's correct. This past year, we did some extensive research on the Almond Conference. As always, we want to make sure that we're continuously improving the conference to meet the needs of our industry. And especially our exhibitors and sponsors and attendees. So we are excited to return to the Safe Credit Union Convention Center in downtown Sacramento this December 5th through 7th.
Very good. And now you're in the planning process. Things are coming together. But does the conference have an official theme yet for this year?
Yes, it does. I'm excited to share that this year's theme is connecting the dots. So we know, obviously, that the networking and the educational opportunities at TAC are the key drivers of all attendees. And while this conference is one that aims to primarily serve growers and handlers, right, they're our target audience. Over the years, it has brought in more of a global audience, especially those on the customer and consumer side of the industry. So the goal with connecting the dots is to really have, you know, a place for conference to be not only connect those different audiences, but also share what's going on in various fields in the industry and how they connect to one another. Everything from growers and handlers to customers and consumers. So we're really excited, really looking forward to all the connections that are going to be made at this year's conference.
Well, very cool. And I know we'll probably get into the weeds a little bit more on the agenda as that gets ironed out. But as of now, are there any maybe major structural changes or some changes that people can look forward to this year?
Yeah. We're definitely currently working on the specific content and sessions. So we don't have that information yet, but we do have the general agenda structure. And that's available on almonds.com/conference on the agenda page. But the structure as a whole will be very similar to what it was last year for any attendees. So we'll kick off on Tuesday morning with some sessions. That day we'll also have state of the industry in the opening reception. And then Wednesday, we'll start off with a general session. We'll have a lunch that Wednesday. We'll have breakout sessions, trade show time throughout the day. And then the gala dinner will take place Wednesday evening. And then Thursday, we'll have some breakout sessions and trade show time. And everything will end right around noon on Thursday. We're looking forward to that. We hope to have the official session information available soon.
And now with the gala, I know that there were some changes made to it last year with kind of moving to a different night. But sounds like there's going to be maybe some more tweaks to the gala this year a little bit.
Yeah. So the gala last year, it was a success having it on Wednesday night. So we are keeping that on Wednesday for this year as well. And this year, just, you know, for those of you who may not be aware, our CEO, Richard Waycott, is retiring after 21 years at the Almond Board. So we felt like it was a natural fit for the gala to be kind of that last hurrah and celebration. So we're kind of, instead of having a specific entertainment at the gala like we normally have in the past, it will truly be a night of, you know, we'll have a good dinner, we'll have some networking opportunities, and then go into some, you know, our Almond Achievement Award winner, our Almond Technical Award winner. And then the rest of the night will really be just kind of a recognition and acknowledgement of Richard and his service to the industry. So we're really looking forward. You know, he's done a lot of amazing work on behalf of the industry over the past two decades. So we're really looking forward to this opportunity to celebrate him.
That is pretty cool. Just maybe in lieu of the entertainment, just allowing some more fellowship and feedback and really celebrate what Richard has done there. So that seems like a neat thing to do for the gala this year. And now looking at other parts of the conference, obviously it's a massive trade show that is also a part of this. So I assume you guys are in the process of filling those booths out so far this year.
Yeah, booth sales opened a couple months ago, and they're currently open, but sales are going really well. The trade show is filling out. The floor plan's very similar to last year's floor plan in terms of size and layout, and we're currently at more than 70% of the space sold. So there's still booth spaces available for anyone who wants to exhibit. And we have a lot of great information on the value of exhibiting on our website on almonds.com/conference. Under the exhibitor and sponsorship page.
Very cool. And now what are maybe some important dates that people are going to want to keep in mind? I know that hotel date can be a pretty important one, but what are some of the other dates that are going to be coming out here as we tread forward towards December and towards conference?
Yeah, definitely. The two big dates are always registration and hotels. So registration will open on August 15th. So that will be available on almonds.com/conference. You can go in there. As always, registration is free for the conference. There are costs associated with the gala and the lunch and the breakfast. But other than that, it is free to attend. So that date is August 15th. And then also the hotel date. We're happy to partner with some of our hotels we've used in the past in the downtown Sacramento area. And those hotels will go live on September 12th. So that's definitely a date you want to mark on your calendar. Our hotels, especially the Hyatt and the Sheraton, always book up really quickly. So want to make sure you get that on your calendars and save that date and be ready for that time.
Yeah, I'll definitely be putting that on my calendar. I know that that can be a bit challenging sometimes if you're not there fairly early. So definitely keep that marked on your calendar. And you'd mentioned a site to go to for potential exhibitors, but where can other industry members or people curious about conference, where can they go to just stay up to date as new things come out and the agenda gets finalized? Where can people stay informed on that?
Yeah, all current information and all information that will be added will be available on almonds.com/conference. So that will be take you to the landing page of all things conference, and we will make sure to keep that up to date with all of the current information as we move toward December 5th through 7th.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Milk prices skyrocketing higher. Milk prices are quickly heading higher this summer. The market actions follow oversupply issues. Brian Doherty, Stuart Peterson Senior Marketing Advisor, says milk prices are following summer temperatures higher.
In part because of the warm weather. Certainly that has some impact. We're going to look at our most warm stretch of the season with high humidity. And then when you get down in the southwest, they've just been cooking there for a long time. And anytime you see in a fundamental news place where you start to see headline news, usually that's a sign that things are finally bubbling to the surface.
Milk dumping and oversupply and too many dairy cattle in the system were all factors in the market.
And so what happens is when the market turns, the market will often find that the sellers have got their trigger points above where the market is to get out of their sold positions or shorts. You've got speculators already jumping on the long side. And now when a market moves one direction, you get some additional what I call unintended purchases. So you get all kinds of volatility in the marketplace. But we've seen over the last several months, the producer is being pinched so hard that they're making moves to become more efficient. And then lastly, you've got a strong cattle pricing complex, beef complex, good to move cows in that environment.
Doherty offers this advice to dairy producers.
What worries me just a little bit is that the downtrend extended itself for a long period of time, and all of a sudden we get this quick flip and we get maybe some cheese demand, we get some weather. But those things, demand and weather, can change. It's not necessarily a long-term vision of less supply. So what we need to see is really probably the herd contract some. But I'm always a fan of when we have an ample supply situation, making sure and rewarding the market on those supplies, because this can disappear quickly. Start hedging in or start selling into this, but do it lightly. Let the trend try and be your friend right now.
NAFB contributed to that report, and with more agriculture news, what does the future of the wildfire season look like? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey looks at some of the factors that could contribute to an increase in wildfire activity here in the West during the remaining summer months and into fall.
Now, what happens in the Southwest is largely dependent on the evolution of the southwestern monsoon circulation. To this point in the season, it has been a very weak and erratic monsoon. until we get more regular rains in the Southwest, you can continue to expect to see wildfire activity from time to time in the Southwest. And then as we move later into summer, we will be watching places like California, the Great Basin, and the Northwest for increased wildfire activity now that we have finally achieved dry enough conditions to fuel wildfires. One concern is that because of the wet winter, we have a lot of growth of some of the finer fuels, grasses and brush that developed on a seasonal basis just because of the wet winter. Those make excellent fire starters, unfortunately. So we will be watching some of those areas that had a wet winter but have now dried out. Some of those finer fuels can help to spark large wildfires once the flammability reaches the point that it has now where we can have the ignition.
And with more on heat and weather, here's USDA's Rod Bain with USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Well over a month in much of the southern plains and desert southwest of extreme heat.
And that is obviously taking a toll on some summer crops, non-irrigated agriculture, and rangeland and pastures.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says perhaps the poster site for these weather conditions, Phoenix, Arizona.
We have now racked up through July 24th a string of 25 consecutive days in Phoenix, Arizona, where the high temperature has been 110 degrees or higher. That easily breaks that city's old record, which had been 18 days, set back in June of 1974.
In addition, nighttime relief from the heat has been minimal. Again, looking at Phoenix.
Back on July 19th, we saw a minimum temperature of 97 degrees in Phoenix. That was a station all-time record high minimum.
With western heat now expanding into places like California, the Great Basin, and the Pacific Northwest. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.